Our fifth case for this morning is United States against Hemphill, 11-1372. Mr. Ravitz.
May it please the Court, Mr. Madden. My name is Gary Ravitz. I am here today to discuss, in the case of my client, the appellant John Hemphill. We thank you for this opportunity. However, I would be remiss before I get into the issues we've raised in our brief if I didn't at least try to explain that in filing the motion in this court to hold this appeal in abeyance, I was motivated not only out of sincere concern for Mr. Hemphill, but I was also prompted by a principle that, that there are some constitutional rights that strike me as being so fundamental that you can never have harmless error. The court referred to this as a structural defect, and the events that are detailed in that motion prompted me to stop and consider whether the possibility that Mr. Hemphill, who represented himself in a federal criminal trial, might be mentally retarded, perhaps raises
I wondered, defect. Mr. Ravitz.
Yes.
I wondered if anyone considered making an insanity defense.
Judges, I can't speak for the counsel who preceded me in the case. I certainly did not make that request of the court to investigate whether there is a ground for a defense based on insanity. But the events that did unfold as part of, as detailed in that motion to hold the appeal in abeyance, certainly were prompted, as I say, by my concern that we have what amounts to a structural error in this case. And I appreciate the government's position and apparently the court's view that the matters aren't really spread of record in this case.
Well, that's the big problem. I don't know whether there's any ground for collateral relief, 2255, but when it's not part of the record, normally speaking, we really can't do anything about it. Hopefully, you know, in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons or whatever, care that he needs is being given.
And I respect that, but I guess I'm having trouble today separating the my suspicions based on what I do know about the case now from the trial error we've raised here regarding the issue of judicial notice. It's hard for me to separate those two. So I'm going to spend my time today talking about the sentencing issues because I think the court could decide those based on the record before it in this case. First and foremost,
you know, before you start, there is something. I'm so sorry that it's so hard for all of you to hear me. The government had pointed out that if the 2008 conviction had been counted as relevant conduct, it would have increased the total amount of loss to over $1 million, thereby increasing the offense level an additional 2 points. And ultimately, that would evoke
I guess my response would be twofold. One, that's an argument that the government makes for the first time in this appeal. It was never raised below. Secondly, I'm not prepared to concede the point. In fact, the judge did not make that finding, and no evidence of any additional loss was presented to the judge because, in effect, the judge overruled our objection to the way Mr. Hemphill's criminal history was calculated.
But the point is, though, that this offense is in the record, and if it were, as you were suggesting it should be, folded in as relevant conduct, then it would be relevant conduct. Then it would be added on to the losses that were already being added up.
Well, so what that would equate to would be, the amount would be more than $230,000 when you add that theft by deception. And we're talking about a difference of between 10 and 35 additional months.
Well,
and, you know, so I, so your response was, no, that isn't something you had. I mean, I assume this isn't something, or have you discussed this with Mr. Hemphill?
Sure.
The risk of this relevant conduct matter, and the fact that he could face more time if we rule in the way you've suggested. Has that been discussed with him?
Well, I can represent to the court that it was. But, again, now in light of what's happened, I mean, there's a question whether the extent to which Mr. Hemphill understood. So
maybe you want to withdraw that argument.
Well, Judge, I guess you can resolve it simply by finding that, on the one hand, the government and the judge were correct in arguing that, in this case, it is not severable, or it is severable as criminal history, and leave it as is. I guess I would, that'd be something I'd like to consider, though.
Well, if you would like to take some time to consider whether you would like to withdraw that argument, we can give you, is a week enough?
Sure.
Okay,
well,
so you can,
where is he?
He's in California. I mean, one of the problems I would have is, I will tell you that communicating with him by telephone without an order of the court.
Yes.
What's
is
a
not
reasonable
done.
Time? Do you, a couple of weeks?
Yeah, sure.
Because you're still covered under CJA.
Right.
So you could be funded to go see him.
I could. I am commencing a trial in about a week and a half, though, from Judge Norgel. If it's important for me to see him, I'm happy to do that, of course. I may need additional time to do that. I do have trial commitments.
I would leave that to your judgment, whether telephone or some other method of communication versus a personal visit is all right. And I'll give you 14 days from now. You certainly, if you're in trial, you don't need to take every day. And you can notify the court if there have been logistical problems that require an extension.
Judge, the only thing I might request is if...
Can I just ask, how long is a normal trial?
Probably a week at the outside. So a single defendant. Mm-hmm. But if the court were willing to issue an order permitting me to call him, I think his institution would honor that.
But that's been the problem. You haven't been able to get through the bureau.
Right. They told me, I did try to call him previously.
So
we ended up having
a court order.
It would help.
We can do that.
And then they would make it, I could
that
resolve
way you
this
could
matter
resolve
quite a bit
it
faster, yeah.
Okay.
Promptly. All right. That will be part of the order.
So let me hold that issue on the side and turn then to a secondary sentencing issue with respect to intended loss. And I guess I have 2 points about the intended loss. The first is that I think based on the document, let's call that Exhibit B here, the receipt, that it appears that reasonable people can disagree about the effect of that document. Now, while the government protests here in effect that, well, the probation officer's stuff was entirely fresh and new, in fact, it's based on the identical evidence. Turning to the government's version of the offense, in addition to Exhibit B, the government spends in excess of a page detailing the interactions between Mr. Hemphill and the Iqbaluddins. Yet at page 7 of its memo, it concludes that the loss in this case was not in excess of $200,000. Now, subsequently, in the PSR, and I think it's at page 11, the probation officer specifically cross-references or refers to the government's version of the offense and, in particular, this same Exhibit B. And thereafter, in advance of sentencing, the government, in its sentencing memo, states, and I believe this is at page 8, that what's in the PSR is identical, essentially, to what we learned during our investigation of this case.
But don't people take another look at this? I mean, we have the interview of Iqbaluddin, and then we also have this receipt with the notation of the amount. Isn't that evidence that the district court could rely on for that extra money? It's the judge. This wasn't a case where the government and the defendant agreed on a sentence. The district judge had that ultimate responsibility.
True. And I guess my response would be that the judge, in effect, delegated, if you will, his duty to determine witness credibility to a probation officer, because a probation officer's statement is nothing more than an opinion. He says, I credit Mrs. Iqbaluddin's recollections. And I believe that Mr. Hemphill intended this loss. Those are statements of opinion. Now, he may be entitled to his opinion, but the government didn't produce any evidence at the hearing itself.
But wasn't there a receipt?
That the receipt, the Exhibit B. And I'm suggesting that the exhibit by itself is not sufficient to permit the finding of intended loss because the government and the probation officer have taken completely opposite views what it means. The government can't claim it didn't know about it. It's their exhibit. So I think what tipped things here, and I see my time's up, is that the judge relied on the probation officer's opinion. I guess he was entitled, the probation officer was entitled to his opinion, but that, in my view, was not evidence the judge could rely on, especially when the intended loss here raised the offense level to such an extent.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Madden.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Matthew Madden on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, the District Court did not commit clear error when it concluded the two prior state convictions were not relevant conduct and instead count as criminal history. First, Your Honor, both of those sentences were imposed prior to the conduct that led to the instant, underlying the instant federal conviction. Under the guidelines, that means that they count as prior criminal history rather than relevant conduct. Specifically with respect to the 2008 perjury conviction that this court raised with Mr. Ravitz, that was a tax fraud case. That was very different than the conduct at issue in this case, which was a real estate fraud scheme and false impersonation of a federal officer. It does not meet the relevant conduct standard as the same course of conduct or a common scheme. In addition, as this court pointed out and as the government pointed out in its brief, it does not make sense for the defense to go forward with this because if that is relevant conduct, there was approximately $600,000 at loss of loss involved in the 2008 conviction, which would put the defendant over $1 million in terms of the amount of loss under 2B1.1, effectively increasing his offense level by 2 points. And even though there'd be a one-level drop in his criminal history, that would still be, of course, this corresponding range would be higher than what he'd be facing if it were just criminal history. For those reasons, Your Honor, the court should affirm the district court on that issue and find that it was not clearly erroneous for the court to conclude that those two prior state convictions were not relevant conduct and instead count as criminal history. With respect to the final sentencing issue that Mr. Ravitz raised, it was not clear error for the district court to conclude, and his calculation of the amount of loss was not clearly erroneous.
I think what he's arguing is it must be that this information about Ms. Iqbaluddin's loss was perhaps just not reliable enough. There's this receipt that the government didn't even seem to think was reliable enough to use, and then the probation officer seems to be more impressed with the interview, but there's no hearing at which she appears, is there?
No, she did not testify. The government briefly interviewed her prior to trial. Hmm. At that time, she produced the receipt. The probation officer did a further interview of Ms. Iqbaluddin. She was victimized in a number. She was a victim who bought a whole number of different properties that were purported to be sold by the defendant to her. And so the government interviewed her about a number of things. This was just one of many issues that they interviewed her about. The probation officer then did a follow-up interview. After the government reviewed the results of that follow-up interview and compared it to the receipt that was produced, it matched. It corroborated each other. That receipt is in the government's appendix at government exhibit GA-32. And this receipt, which the district court, which was attached to the government's sentencing memo as well, was very similar to a receipt that was introduced at trial that the defendant had given the undercover officer after purporting to sell him a property. So, here's what it corroborates. It says it's from Abul Iqbaluddin, makes a payment of $3,500. Abul is Sabera's husband, and she had informed probation and the government that she and her husband owned this gas station at 44th Street in Chicago, that she owed $1.6 million on it, and that the defendant said that he was part of the U.S. government, and if they would just pay her approximately $600,000, he would modify the loan and she wouldn't have to pay the rest. So that $600,000 figure is corroborated by this remaining balance figure of $637,000, and then this is also a receipt of a payment of $3,500 that the Ickbaludens made as a, I guess, a mortgage payment to Mr. Hemphill. Then you also see Mr. Hemphill's signature over U.S. receiving officer, which was consistent with how he carried out the scheme that's described. That was there was evidence of that at trial. So all of those factors. All of these circumstances corroborated what Ms. Ickbaludin said in her report to the probation officer. In putting all that together, it was not clearly erroneous for the court to conclude this should be in the amount of loss section. I think Mr. Ravitz said this is something that reasonable people could disagree about, but that's not enough to meet the clearly erroneous standard that we have here on appeal, Your Honor. For those reasons, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm both the conviction and the sentence in this case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think your time ran out, Mr. Ravitz, but if you would like a minute, you may have it, or if not, you don't need to take it.
With respect to the first sentencing issue with respect regarding criminal history, I appreciate the court's opportunity to let me discuss with Mr. Hemphill. I guess one area where the government and I kind of disagree on the way the numbers would be calculated, though, is that with a full reduction of the criminal history score, I think it actually puts Mr. Hemphill in a 70 to 87 month range, which
and after you add the new
I believe
money
so
in?
Yeah I believe 25 the 2-level increase, but there would be a corresponding deduction in criminal history. Now I guess it depends how far one goes with the criminal history, so theoretically you're right, he could end up certainly with more time. If the judge reduced it by 7 points, which is what I think we requested, it would drop him down sufficiently to actually provide a potentially lower low-end sentence. But
both of the convictions. We're just talking about that one, aren't we?
Right, but I was moving, in the brief, we said the scheme, according to the government, goes back to 2002. Therefore, theoretically, his whole thing, all his entire criminal history is subsumed by this charge, which indicted that no later than 2008 he entered the scheme. But the government's criminal complaint was based on a sworn allegation the scheme actually originated in 2002. So my position was basically all of his priors are out the window. But if I lose on those, then I would agree with you that he could end up in a worse position. Obviously, that was part of the nature of our conversation. So.
All right. Thank you very much. And we do appreciate your help to your client and to the court.
Thank you. And I'll look forward to that order.
All right. Sure. The case is taken under advisement. And we will move on to our